Welcome to the World Next Week's special Election 2020 episode. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay.
Jim, and there's just 40 days now until November 3rd. And so naturally, our focus for this episode is the upcoming U.S. presidential election. In particular, we want to highlight American attitudes towards foreign policy in the run-up to the elections. And our gateway into the discussion is the annual survey conducted by the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. This year's report is titled Divided We Stand, which gives us a glimpse at the poll's findings.
Joining us for this special episode are Ivo Dalder and Dina Smeltz. Ivo is the president of the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. He served as the U.S. Ambassador to NATO from 2009 to 2013. Before that, he was a senior fellow in foreign policy studies at the Brookings Institution, specializing in American foreign policy, European security, and transatlantic relations. Ivo has written widely and well on all those topics. He and I have co-authored two books, America Unbound, The Bush Revolution in Foreign Policy, and more recently, The Empty Throne, America's Abdication of Global Leadership. Dina is Senior Fellow for Public Opinion and Foreign Policy at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. She has 25 years of experience designing, fielding, and evaluating international social and political surveys. She is the lead pollster for Divided We Stand and has authored and co-authored numerous reports based on her surveying and polling work. Now, some numbers are likely to come up in today's conversation, so let me note right at the top that you can find a copy of the Chicago Council's annual report available for free at its website, chicagocouncil.org. With those preliminaries out of the way, Dean and Ivo, congratulations on this year's survey, and welcome to the world next week.
Thank you so much. Thanks for inviting us.
Great to be here, Jim, Bob. Wonderful to have a conversation.
So for starters, Dina, I'd like to ask you to kind of walk us through Divided We Stand in terms of how the survey was conducted, maybe geographic scope and the size of the survey and so forth.
Sure. Well, every year since 2014, we have conducted the survey. It is an annual check-in with the American public's mood on foreign policy specifically. And this year, we conducted the survey from July 2nd to the 19th among a representative national sample of 2,111 adults. That means that it's full coverage of the entire country, urban, rural, suburban, and across all different racial groups, ages, and political affiliations. And the survey is conducted online by Ipsos Public Affairs. And why we use them is because it's one of the largest national samples that is available to us. And it has a panel that is representative of the entire U.S. population. And for those people who do not have internet access, they provide internet access to individuals so that we can feel confident that we have a fully representative sample of the United States public.
And it's titled Divided We Stand. Can you give us the big points that you would highlight on why that's the case?
Sure. Well, this year we focused on the impact of the coronavirus, the economic downturn on attitudes toward foreign policy. And what really struck us when we looked at the results as soon as they came back was how Republicans and Democrats seem almost to be living in different worlds. What they're concerned about, their top threats are very different. For Republicans, the top threat is China. For Democrats, it is COVID-19. They see the best way to address the threats very, very differently. They support different kinds of approaches to achieve U.S. foreign policy goals. But at the same time, one of the surprising findings was that we thought, oh, this might be a year where we see the American public turning inward, withdrawing from world affairs, given all that's happened. But we did not find that. We found continued support for international engagement and alliances and free trade.
Ivo, can we pick up on Dina's point about the divided public that Democrats and Republicans seem to be seeing the world very differently, have a very different definition of threats? And can we link it to what Dina mentioned, one of the big topics you wanted to tackle, the coronavirus? What exactly are the differences between Democrats and Republicans when it comes to COVID-19 and the pandemic?
So the most important difference is how they see the threat of COVID represented and how what the impact is of having experienced this pandemic. So for Democrats, the number one and most important threat currently to the United States, 87% of Democrats, is the COVID-19 pandemic. Republicans don't have that in the top seven threats. It's in fact ranked ninth on the list of threats in Republicans. Independents, by the way, also have COVID as the largest threat, which is why the overall Americans think that the COVID-19 pandemic is the most critical threat towards the United States. But it's this distinction between Democrats and Republicans, one, seeing a global threat like a pandemic, as indeed climate change, which is ranked number two by Democrats, and Republicans just not seeing this as a threat. And how does that play out then in terms of what to do about it and how to think about it in terms of their foreign policy? We asked which of the following two statements comes closest to your views. The coronavirus outbreak has made it clear that it is more important for the United States either coordinate and collaborate with countries to solve global issues or be self-sufficient as a nation so we don't need to depend on others. Republicans overwhelmingly favor being self-sufficient, 58% of Republicans. Democrats even more overwhelmingly believe that COVID has demonstrated that we need to cooperate and collaborate with other countries. 80% of Democrats believe that. So you have a completely different worldview in terms of the threats and, logically, actually, a quite very different view about how to deal with the threats and how to engage the world.
Ivo, it may take us a bit beyond the survey, but do we have any explanation for why Democrats and Republicans see the same set of facts and come to very different views on their meaning?
I think we are seeing a deepening divide on foreign policy issues that we've seen on so many other issues in our country. And the leaders happen to be, in this case, in this campaign, represent their voters very well. You have on the Republican side a focus on security issues and a belief that the best way to tackle those issues is to use the power of the United States to deal with it, a sort of what we call a nationalist approach, an America First approach, you might call it, given that Donald Trump represents that kind of view. On the Democratic side, you have a much more collaborative internationalist approach, the belief that these problems are so large and so significant that you really have to work together with other countries. And indeed, that is the dividing line in this election. This is not just something refining voters saying. This is also the dividing line between Democrats and Republicans on Capitol Hill, but increasingly between the Democratic candidate and the Republican candidate. And therefore, in some ways, the election is more consequential on foreign policy as it is on so many other things, then I think any election we've had since 1940, because the choice that is going to be made will have a direct and immediate impact on the foreign policy that will be pursued. You're either going to have a nationalist foreign policy, a doubling down of Donald Trump's America First point of view, or we're going to have a fundamental shift back to a much more internationalist and collaborative foreign policy. But we're not going to have a mixture of both, which is what history and American foreign relations has been for so long. So in that sense, it truly is consequential.
You know, I was struck by going through the report, and I think it takes pains not to say that this is a isolationist movement going on in the United States, but yet a different way of viewing the world and the way the U.S. should be engaged with it. And in some of the findings, which you, Ivo, you or Dina could elaborate on, there is also discussion of different ways in which the U.S. should be engaging the world. But you've already seen the manifestation of some of this approach in terms of Donald Trump's approach to international agreements, his appearance at the U.N. General Assembly this week, or I should say his virtual appearance, where he doubled down on that in a very kind of sort of brief address. Could you talk a little bit about then, if it's not isolationist, what kind of engagement are we seeing emerging then, and why is that becoming so popular amongst Republicans and amongst so many Republicans?
I mean, I think what we're seeing is the continuation of the kind of foreign policy that Donald Trump has been pursuing for 4 years and refining a Republican electorate, increasingly buying into that policy. And it means, you know, as he said in his address, repeating what he said in every address to the UN General Assembly, all I'm doing is what I think you all should be doing, talking to leaders of other countries. You should pursue your national interest first. And I'm going to pursue my American interest first. And you should pursue your Chinese or Russian or French or Burmese interest first. That's what you should be doing. And he has a view of the world in which nations are competing in a win-lose kind of framework, in which the bigger you are, the better you are, the more, if you think about this as a billiard ball model of the world, when you have more mass, you can push people around. And so we are able, as the United States, as the biggest economy, as the biggest military power, work to get our way in trying to do what it is that we want to do. That's one view of the world. It's one that, by the way, is not particularly new in American foreign policy. It just hasn't been embraced to this extent by one party to the exclusion of the other party. It is something that I think is now solidified as a Republican point of view. And that's what's important and interesting, just as the opposite point of view really has solidified as a Democratic approach to foreign policy. So the deep divisions and polarization we see in the country are now extended to the place that used to be where politics did not interfere, foreign policy.
And I would just add that I think that the two different approaches is on the Democratic side, it's a cooperative approach within the international community. So working within the international institutions, many which have been either reduced participation for the U.S. under Trump or complete withdrawal. Same with international agreements where we've withdrawn from Paris and the Iran agreement where Democrats would support that type of thing. And they see a greater role for the international community and international organizations, where on the Republican side and President Trump, they coincide, is more about the primacy of U.S. interests, U.S. power first, and they support more forceful approaches, the peace through strength type of approach where we should use tariffs, we should use our superior military power, not necessarily in interventions, but as a deterrence, and to even use coercion on some domestic matters too, like protests to keep law and order. So I think all those ideas do resonate, especially among the two candidates today, and it does resonate among the constituents as well.
Dina, can I draw you out a bit more on this question of isolationism versus internationalism? I mean, one of the great questions the Chicago Council has asked for a number of years is, do you think it would be best for the future of the country if we take an active part in world affairs or if we stay out of world affairs? This is sort of trying to get at that isolationist versus internationalist division that's presumed to be in the American public. And I will note that a lot of policymakers and a lot of journalists write about America turning inward, America becoming more isolationist. Is that what you're seeing in this year's poll?
So no, we see the opposite, continued support for participating in the world, in international cooperation to some extent. The problem that Ivo and I have come across when people talk about isolationism is that a lot of people conflate isolationism with a desire not to intervene militarily. And that's a fair point. Americans generally don't want to send U.S. troops abroad or get involved in most cases. However, they are willing to defend allies. But that is only one small piece of America's involvement in the world. So we just find continued support for free trade, for supporting various agreements, for speaking with hostile actors to try to make some diplomatic leeway, and very strong support for alliances continued over time. And on a lot of these measures, we've seen, in fact, increases in support for free trade since 2016. We see increases in support for defending South Korea over time. So we really, since 1974, the Chicago Council has always found between 6 and 7 in 10 Americans supporting being active in world affairs. But they do want shared leadership, not a dominant leadership, but very few, less than 1 in 10, say that the United States should have no leadership role. So I think a lot of it is semantics of isolationism and what that entails.
I'm just curious, just a little add on that. I note, maybe I'm misreading the survey results, but you found that 54% of Americans say they want the United States to be more involved in the world.
Yes.
Is this atypical?
This is the first time we asked that question. So that is higher among Democrats than it is of Republicans. And some of that is a backlash against Trump's current policy of withdrawing from American leadership. I think especially the COVID numbers show that. It's very stark that only a small minority, I think 20% of Democrats, think that the United States government has done an effective job handling the COVID crisis, where 67% of Republicans think it has been effective. So some of that sentiment about the United States should be doing more is because they think that we have abdicated leadership in a lot of areas.
Can I pick up on Dina's point that is very important about when in Washington one talks about the United States and the American people wanted to retreat from the world and withdraw from the world, and why our survey year after year doesn't find it? It's increasingly evident that when the blob, as Ben Rhodes used to call it. This Washington establishment thinks about American involvement. It has a particular definition of what it means to be engaged in world affairs. It means to be a indispensable global leader that tells other countries what to do, to use its overwhelming economic, political, and diplomatic might to get its way and to, by force or other circumstances, try to shape the world in America's image, and that's what engagement is about. And that anything less really is a retreat. And what we're finding in our surveys is actually that's not what Americans think we should be doing. But it doesn't mean that we should just come home, build higher walls and bigger moats so that nobody can come here. What they want to do is actually go back to a pretty traditional way of engaging abroad, working with our friends and allies, supporting them through a shared both leadership and a shared burdens of defending them, working with them to open up economic capabilities and the systems and supporting free trade, defending and promoting human rights, but not through the use of force, but more through the example, through the traditional pillars of American foreign policy. Americans are overwhelmingly in favor of that. What they don't want to do is to sort of take the power we have, and whether we do it together with other countries or not, sort of make our way around the world and shape it in our own image. And I think we need to get away from this idea that that form of foreign policy, the kind of hubristic foreign policy of the post-Cold War period, is the norm. It's actually not an American public that people don't support it. But it doesn't mean they want to go home. And this is not the late 1930s in Chicago. This is a very different engaging public.
And I just add that in open-ended comments, when we have provided those in our survey, people continuously say that, look, we live in a globalized, interconnected world. There's no turning back from that. So we can't, even if we wanted to, we couldn't really withdraw from the rest of the world.
I wonder if we take the issue, just the issue of the coronavirus, for example, and we envision Joe Biden wins presidency and he's staked out a position in which there is a return to some of these things that Ivo mentioned. You know, the U.S. would reengage with the World Health Organization. It would take a leadership role in trying to find a global approach to vaccine development and distribution and leading a pandemic response for future pandemics and so forth. It possibly, it's already been written and cited in a number of places. The world is sort of getting a little bit of whiplash potentially from the United States. And it could find a world that's like not so receptive to an America that wants to do that. And it makes me wonder whether we need to have more of a domestic reckoning about what our positions are, where are the common points before the U.S. can craft some kind of effective foreign policy.
I think from a world public opinion standpoint, I think public opinion can be pretty resilient. I'm struck by, if you look at Pew, just put out a survey of international views toward the United States, and the views of Trump are low, but they were similar to views under George W. Bush around the Iraq War, where people around the world were also very disappointed and dismayed by American leadership then. And then with Obama in between, we were able to rebound a lot of that support. So I think the world could be forgiven if the United States had a different tone and set of actions.
So I have a less optimistic view of this for two reasons. One, because of the data, but the other, because of the other findings in the Pew poll. So this is, as Dina rightly says, when our allies and friends, publics are asked, you know, do you think that the leader of the United States, George Bush, Obama, or Trump, you can count on them to do the right thing in world affairs? It was very low under Bush. It's very low under Trump. It was really high under Obama. So it may go higher under Biden. But the reality is, if you can go down not just once, but twice, you probably can go down a third time in electing a leader who is not going to be able to do the right thing in world affairs. And at some point, people are going to get disillusioned with the United States and not trust it to do the right thing. And the second piece that was particularly worrisome in the Pew poll that came out on public attitudes towards the United States is that the favorability rating of the United States, as opposed to its leader, is also collapsing. And it used to be that people could bifurcate the view between whether the president of the United States was doing the right thing and whether they liked the United States. Now, increasingly, those two are coming together so that the mean among our friends and allies favorability rating of the United States is 34%. That is not a good place to be. It's, in fact, below where, in many cases, China is with regard to our friends and allies. And it's that distrust. There's a lot of damage that's been done in allied countries because of the relationship that we have pursued over the last 3 to 4 years and because of COVID. We've mishandled COVID, and people who believed that the United States could do everything and anything at any time looked at a country and said, wait a minute, what happened to this country that you can't deal with this pandemic? Whereas we name it, Italians, Danes, Germans, Singaporeans, South Koreans all figured out how to do this, and you still haven't figured it out. So public opinions can change, there's no doubt, and it certainly did in 2009, 2010, and other places, but it's going to be a harder slog to get back into the good graces of our allies. Not, by the way, that getting into the good graces of our allies is an objective in and of itself, but it's pretty important if you want to cooperate.
Ivo, if I may, can I sort of flip that question rather than looking outside into the United States, look from the United States outward? And I want to take advantage of the fact that you were U.S. ambassador to NATO and talk a little bit about how Americans think about alliances. Obviously, you have Donald Trump, who campaigned and is governed by criticizing our allies. He's been very vocal about it, talking about how they have essentially shirked their duties. He talks about them not paying their bills at NATO and elsewhere. We've had acrimonious negotiations over host country support. Presumably, if we have a President Biden, he would take a different approach toward alliances. A lot of talk about restoration, if I can use that word. But just sort of looking at the results of the Shell Council survey, what do Americans think about alliances, particularly given we talk about NATO, we talk at its core, Article 5, we will come and defend you if you are in trouble, one for all and all for one. What does the survey tell us?
Americans in general think that alliances are a good thing for the United States and help enhance American security. So if we've asked the question of, do you think alliances mostly benefit our allies, mostly benefit ourselves, or mostly benefit both of us? And by margins of 61% to 70%, Americans think that they mostly benefit the United States or the United States and its allies for alliances in Asia, in Europe, and in the Middle East. And specifically when we asked the question on NATO, which is, of course, the most important longest-standing alliance, we asked, do you think the United States should maintain, increase, or reduce its commitment to NATO? And we're finding now that about three-quarters of Americans, 73%, should we either increase or maintain our commitment with NATO? I'll add to that, we did ask a specific question on whether people supported the withdrawal of 12,000 troops from Germany, which President Trump had announced. And I'll be the first to admit, I was surprised. There's not only is there a majority support for supporting it, the withdrawal of those troops, that support is across the board. It's higher among Republicans and Democrats, but the majority of Democrats also think that it is time to reduce our troop commitment in Germany, not actually when we've asked this over time in many other places. The commitment to Germany seems to be less among Americans than it is for Korea or Japan or other places. And indeed, when we asked the question, do you support the use of U.S. troops to defend NATO allies like the Baltic states, over 52% support using U.S. troops to fulfill the collective defense commitment. So bottom line is there is strong latent support and belief in alliances. Indeed, when we ask what's the most effective way for the United States to achieve its objectives, alliances are at the very top of how Americans think about that. But, and there is a but, it is clear that President Trump's insistence on other countries doing more and doing the burden is widely supported by Americans. And the next president of the United States may use different tactics and certainly a different tone, but I think he will be well advised to continue to find ways to get allies to pony up more in terms of both spending on defense and carrying responsibility for maintaining global order, because that's also where the public is.
I should note, Ivo, that President Trump is not the first American president to have asked allies to do more. As you know from firsthand experience, President Obama worked to try to get the allies to spend more on defense at NATO. That was the result of the 2014 Wales Summit, I believe, to make this commitment to spending 2% of one's gross domestic product on defense. So that may partly explain why you get some support for this across party lines. This has been a common argument made by both Republican and Democratic presidents.
Indeed, it goes back to Harry Truman, I think, was the first U.S. president to argue that the Europeans should do more on defense. So it is a well-worn refrain. What we haven't had is the implicit and at times even explicit threat to walk out of NATO, which is we've seen under this president. But either way, spending in Europe is going up. My view is tends to go up when they see there is a threat. And given the way that Vladimir Putin is behaving, it shouldn't be surprising that spending goes up.
I'd like to take that last part, actually, Ivo, because it's a fascinating thing for me as I watch the administration, as I watch Republican attitudes towards Russia, where there's a little bit of almost schizophrenia in terms of dismissing Russia as the great overarching threat that had previously been seen as, while at the same time, and certainly President Trump himself will rarely, if ever, mention anything about any sort of crosswords about Russia or Putin himself in particular. But then you have other parts of his administration through 3.5 years or members of Congress who are Republicans who very much have a position of wariness, if not outright concern, expressed strongly about Russia. And yet the administration will, as the president himself does often, speak more about China as this great gathering threat and less so about Russia. Is that something you noticed? Is that something that you saw kind of play out in the results in the survey?
Yeah, before going on, just one point to add to it, and then Dina can tell you about the findings on Russia and public views, because they're actually partisan differences on that too, which is important. You're absolutely right that in fact, the outlier when it comes to Russia is the president within his own administration, and importantly, with regard to Capitol Hill. And Capitol Hill, on alliances, is more united, Democrats and Republicans, than anything else. There is an overwhelming Republican and Democratic support for alliances, including for NATO. There is strong opposition to withdrawing American troops from Germany on Capitol Hill. And again, it's as bipartisan as it gets. I want to underscore that as part of the last answer. But on Russia, there's a growing difference between Democrats and Republicans.
Yeah, so it's interesting. The threat of foreign interference in American elections is at 69% for Democrats. So that's one of the top five threats that they see. And it's not in a top threat for Republicans or for independents, which in the past we've asked about Russian interference specifically, and that also rates high for Democrats and for the FBI too, actually, as Christopher Wray just testified. But Republicans don't see it as much of a threat. They are much less negative toward Russia than Democrats are. And in a flip from, you know, Cold War era, where Republicans were the party of Reagan, spoke up against the evil empire. In a switch now, it's the Democrats who think we should limit Russia's ability to influence world politics, where Republicans are less so and Democrats are more in favor of trying to constrain Russia. Now, on China, it's the opposite. I do want to say, though, but majorities of Republicans and Democrats both support sanctions against Russia. So they do, in a weird way, come together. But when it becomes a domestic political issue, meaning the legitimacy of Donald Trump being president because of Russian interference, that's when Republicans and Democrats split. So on China, now China's the top threat for Republicans at 67%. Both Republicans and Democrats say that China's more of a rival than a partner to the United States. Views of China have plunged. It's in the 32 out of 100 is the temperature reading Americans give to China. But Democrats would like to work and cooperate with China. So they're mirror opposites of each other on the two countries. And again, a lot of that's domestic politics.
So that almost flips the two parties from the 1990s, where you had George Bush Sr. talking about constructive engagement and Bill Clinton coming in and criticizing that until he ultimately embraced it too.
Yeah.
This is part of this distinction between Democrats and Republicans. So just in terms of threat perception, there's a 20-point gap between Democrats and Republicans on the threat of China. 67% of Republicans think it's a threat. Only 47% of Democrats do. It's flipped on Russia. There's a 17-point gap on whether Russia is the rise of Russia, its influence in the world is a threat, with 57% of Democrats seeing it as a threat and just 40% of Republicans seeing it as a threat. Same on the military power of Russia. Who would have thought that Republicans would think it is less of a threat? It is by 12 points, than Democrats, the majority, 51% of Democrats think the military power of Russia is a threat. So it's a flip. And I think that in this case, you really are seeing the influence of the president, both in terms of Russia being less seen as a threat by Republicans and China seeing as a bigger threat by Republicans.
Just to add to Eva's list of the gulf between Republicans and Democrats, there's also a 33% difference between Republicans and Democrats on foreign interference in American elections. And election legitimacy is going to be a big issue, obviously, in the upcoming vote.
If I may, I'd like to change our focus from national security issues to economic ones. Maybe I can draw you out a bit, Dina, on a point you made when we began the conversation about your findings on globalization and trade. And I'll frame my question by noting that, again, one of the standard pieces of journalistic framing is that Americans are anti-trade and they've turned against trade. They think it's rigged against them. But again, when I look at the results from the Chicago survey, trade seems to be, if anything, more popular than it used to be. So can you explain to me what's going on?
Sure. Honestly, I thought this was going to be one of our lead storylines, that support for globalization had collapsed because of COVID. There were so many articles saying COVID is going to be the death of globalization. It's going to force a change in the way we do supply chains, which it still could. But we were really surprised that attitudes toward globalization have actually remained very, very stable. 65% of Americans overall continue to support globalization. That's been 65 since 2014, and that's the highest level it's been. It's been really steady. It's a little bit lower for Republicans now at 55%. It was 62% in 2014, but not a huge drop. And it's very high for Democrats, 75%, as it has been since 2014. So Democrats have really become the bloc that is most pro-globalization and most pro-trade. On trade, it's a similar picture. There are some declines since the last time we asked our questions about whether international trade is good or bad for the U.S. economy, creating jobs in the U.S., consumers like you, and good or bad for U.S. relations with other countries. But it's still solid, healthy majorities supporting a trade in each of these cases. It's a little bit lower since 2018 for some of these, but still much higher than it used to be. In 2016, we saw a big jump, especially among Republicans, who I believe my reading of it is that they had faith that Donald Trump was going to improve trade for America. And so we saw a big jump in those people who said trade would be good. So the support has dropped a little bit from 89. So on U.S. relations with other countries, it went from 89 to 85, which is really nothing. 82% of Americans say it's good for consumers like you, compared to 85 in 2018. And for creating jobs in the U.S., it's now at 59% versus 67% in 2018. So they're all really pretty healthy percentages in support. And it makes me think Americans are really pretty pragmatic. They also generally, in a different question we asked about, in a crisis, would Americans support the United States manufacturing its own goods and keeping its own goods within our borders, not selling them, or support continued dispersed production of goods in several countries? And a majority say we should keep producing abroad in various countries and just make sure that there's enough reserve stocks throughout. So all in all, I think really, really very pragmatic on trade so far.
Although it's interesting to then look at the two main campaigns now, where obviously Trump, you have Make America Great Again, but Joe Biden talking about America First, sort of a manufacturing platform, and a lot of talk about building up the U.S., you know, at home first, as opposed to touting foreign trade deals. That's not something that seems to win any sort of applause on the campaign trail anymore.
Right. I will say most, if you throw in the distinction between doing something at home versus abroad, domestic issues usually do take precedence. So a lot of it is how you word things in a survey question and in politics.
I mean, what's interesting, though, on the supply chain question, so you would have expected, given the absolute disaster we had when it came to PPE, protective personal equipment, and the fact that we didn't have any enough here, and frankly, we still don't have enough here at home, and we're not producing enough, that you could find Americans saying, no, we got to get this stuff here at home and not abroad. And we actually tested that and had two questions that really pushed it, both in terms of the crisis. If there was a crisis, are we better off that many different countries produce these various goods, or whether individual countries make them themselves? And by a 2-to-1 margin, Americans think it's better that if many different countries, you have diverse supply chains rather than singular supply chains. However, Republicans are split on this, basically 50-50 on individual versus diverse. And Democrats are exactly on the opposite side. 75% say dispersed supply chain and 24% say it should be independent. And then we asked them, well, what do you put some money and the cost on it? And asked if the United States will be better off if the U.S. produces critical goods here and does not buy or sell these goods, ensuring our own supplies, even if this means higher prices. 60% of Republicans said, yeah, that's a good idea, but only 28% of Democrats. And then when we asked, alternatively, if countries agree to coordinate this collaborative approach to produce critical goods globally while keeping prices low, even if this means you have to rely on foreign governments for these critical supplies, only 37% of Republicans thought that was a good idea, but 70% of Democrats think it's a good idea. Just, again, emphasizing a self-sufficient nationalist approach on the Republican side versus a collaborative internationalist approach on the Democratic side. And Bob, you're right that on this issue, as on manufacturing, it's not clear that the two candidates are as clearly diverging as their voters seem to be.
Dina, what do the numbers tell us about China? I ask because China is both a national security threat. You think of the threat it's posing, for example, in the South China Sea, threat it poses to Taiwan, to America's treaty allies in East Asia. But it's obviously a very significant economic competitor for the United States. I know you asked a bunch of questions. You told us that sort of favorability rating for China has fallen in the eyes of the American public. It's well below what it used to be. But any more texture you can give us about how Americans see relations with China?
Sure. The percentage that says the development of China as a world power is a critical threat is at 55%. That's the highest that we've ever seen for China as a threat. This happens to be, as we said before, the top threat for Republicans at 67%, and 47% of Democrats see it as a critical threat. So views of China are more unfavorable now than they have been in our survey since we've asked about China. But the differences between Democrats and Republicans are really how to deal with the rise of China's power. They have varying degrees of seeing China as a threat. They both see China as a rival rather than a partner to the United States. They're both unfavorable toward China, but they want to deal with it in different ways. 64% of Republicans say that the United States should actively work to limit the growth of China's power, compared to just 36% of Democrats who actively want to work to limit the growth of China's power. Democrats, 47% of Democrats say that the United States should work cooperatively with China. Both have risen in the percentages that want to actively limit the growth of China, but it has increased 24% from 40% in 2019 to 64% among Republicans. So that's one of the big differences. Then when we asked about specific policies that the United States could take, the Republicans are much more likely to want to take forceful, almost punitive approaches toward China. 79% of Republicans say we should prohibit Chinese technology companies from building communication networks in the United States, compared to 62% of Democrats. 76% of Republicans say we should increase tariffs on products imported from China, compared to just 39% of Democrats. 70% of Republicans say we should significantly reduce trade between the United States and China, even if this leads to greater costs for American consumers, versus 41% of Democrats. 66% of Republicans versus 39% of Democrats support restricting scientific exchange between the United States and China. And 65% of Republicans versus 32% of Democrats say we should limit the number of Chinese students studying in the United States. So those are big differences and largely reflect Democrats' general inclinations to work cooperatively with other countries and reflect Republicans' sense of threat from China today. But on other items, Republicans and Democrats are not that different. So majorities of both prefer support to placing sanctions on Chinese officials responsible for human rights abuses. Majorities of both favor negotiating arms control agreements between the United States and China. Majorities of both favor prohibiting U.S. companies from selling sensitive high-tech products to China. And majorities support working together with China to limit climate change. So there are some areas of overlap, but really the very coercive measures are supported more by Republicans and Democrats. This is the most negative numbers we've seen on China in this survey since we've ever polled. It was in 1986, Americans gave China a rating of 53 out of 100, and now it's at 32. So this was a big drop. And the numbers are really, really striking. And we will be putting another report out really focused on China. So stay tuned for that.
Which you can find at thechicagocouncil.org.
That's correct.
So following those numbers, Dina, I'll mention again the president's address to the UN General Assembly earlier this week, where he barely started speaking before he started lambasting China and the China virus, went out of his way to criticize Chinese despoiling of the planet in terms of not just climate areas, but just pollution in general. And I guess that's a way of me getting at the issue of climate a little bit, because it was interesting to hear what you say, that people think you can work with China on climate, whereas President Trump's view is that, you know, China is been taking advantage of the international, you know, talks on these fronts and other fronts for years. That's why he set in motion the moving country out of the Paris Climate Agreement. So I'm wondering, you know, on climate in general, whether you're seeing any sort of movement or greater divergence between the two sides that you mentioned at the outset were sort of like people from different planets. The survey was done in July. Things were already starting to get pretty serious climate-wise in this country. I don't think the worst of the California fires had started yet, but I think you'd already started to see some extreme weather happening. And I'm just wondering, and just here in the Washington area, it was felt like Houston the entire month of July. So I'm just wondering whether you were seeing any sort of reflection of climate reality versus climate policy change or not.
Climate change is one of the most divisive issues that we ask about and has been since we started asking about it. Republicans and Democrats are really far apart on it. This year, overall, 50% of Americans say climate change is a critical threat. That's actually a little bit down from previous years, and just like 4%. Last year was the first time a true majority said climate change was a critical threat, and that has been rising. So 50% is a little bit lower, but not much. It's 75% of Democrats name it as a critical threat. It's one of the top threats after COVID, and only 21% of Republicans say that it is a critical threat. When we ask other questions about it, Republicans and Democrats, there is some common ground. So we've asked questions about whether climate change is a burning issue that has to be dealt with right away, even if there's a lot of costs associated with it. Climate change is a problem, but we can work on it gradually because it's becoming gradually more critical, and then it's not a problem. So even among Republicans, more of them say it's somewhat of a problem, and that had grown a little bit the last time we asked that question. And not in our survey, but what certain Republican strategists have picked up on is that this is the top issue for young Americans. And if the Republican Party wants to maintain traction among young Americans, it's also a high priority for Republican young Americans. Certain legislators have paid attention and are trying to put forth policies or proposals that also address this. So it'll be interesting to see how it changes. And you're right, when temperatures rise or fall, we usually see a shift in concern about climate change. So this poll was done before there was a lot of attention on the wildfires. If someone asked about it now, that might be higher. But yeah, it is a growing concern, a little bit of a setback this year, given all the other issues we're dealing with right now. But it has been the last two or three surveys, one of the top Democratic concerns. And part of that is because it's a younger electorate.
Eva, I'd like to close out by asking about what I consider to be one of the most striking results from the Chicago Council's survey, and one that certainly fits your overarching theme of divided we stand. And that's the response to the question about American exceptionalism. You've been asking a number of years whether people think the United States has a unique character that makes it the greatest country in the world, or whether the United States is no greater than any other country. There has been for a very long time a split between Democrats and Republicans on this question. But it truly widened this year. It's 45 points. 80% of Republicans think that America is exceptional. Only 35% of Democrats do. What do you make of that finding?
So I think it reflects the politics of the moment. Here's where I think domestic politics drives the difference. If you believe, as most Democrats do, that Donald Trump has mishandled the COVID pandemic, has failed to provide a safety net for those who are most directly affected economically, has deepened racial and societal inequality and tensions, has undermined our standing in the world, and yet is leading, is the president of the United States, arguing that this is the greatest country, becomes more difficult, particularly if you define the country in concert with who the leader of that country is. Conversely, if you're a Republican and think that the president has done a good job on all of these aspects, you're just going to continue to have the view that the United States is exceptional. It's better than other countries. So my view is this gets driven by politics. I assume that in a deeply polarized society as ours, these numbers might even flip next year if you have a Democratic president, and particularly if you have a Democratic sweep with a Democratic president, Democratic House. So I do think that's part and parcel of what's going on. The other thing that's going on is a realization, I think, that you know the problems that are out there in the world aren't ones that we can solve by ourselves. And that's, again, a Democratic point of view, that we need to work together. If you think that the biggest issues are climate change and COVID, it's pretty hard to resolve either of those problems by ourselves. You need to do it not only with your friends and allies, but you need to do it with countries like China and bring them in. If, on the other hand, you think the big threats are the traditional security threats, Iran, Korea, Russia, and of course China, and you think you have the power because you're an exceptional country, then you're also going to say, listen, I don't need that kind of cooperation. So in that sense, it reinforces the division that exists between Democrats and Republicans that derives from both the polarization of the country and the reality that we see threats in such a fundamentally different way from a Republican and a Democratic standpoint.
On that note, I'm going to wrap up our Election 2020 special episode. To all of our regular listeners, we hope you enjoyed this special episode of the podcast. Let me remind you that if you want to read more about the Chicago Council's report, you can download a copy of the report at the Chicago Council's website, which is thechicagocouncil.org. I hope all of you will join us in 2 weeks for our regular look at the world next week. In the meantime, Dina, Ivo, thanks again for joining us for this terrific conversation.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Jim. Thanks, Bob. Appreciate it.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program was produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Shirley. Special thanks to Anna Shortridge and Margaret Gatch for their assistance. Zoe Collis also served as our recording engineer this week. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrera and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long, and stay healthy out there.